I want to draw your attention to a film, another film in the series that the research center that I direct sponsors, the Social Cinema Series at the Marquee Theater. This is really an excellent film about the clothing industry, and it bears on some of the themes we'll be talking about in this block of the course on inequality, although it has more of a global perspective. Mostly, I'll be discussing inequality within the United States, not inequality around the world, but still this film bears on the questions of inequality. But more importantly, it's a really terrific documentary. And it brings to the fore aspects of our life which we just take for granted and don't really, in a day-to-day way, appreciate exactly what we're doing. So we're used to, in the United States in recent decades, having clothing be relatively inexpensive. And it's often just hard to forget that real people with real hands, nerves, feelings, emotions, lives actually make the stuff which we wear and make it, in many instances, under conditions which we would find utterly intolerable. This film looks at that in detail. And it's a terrific documentary. You know, some documentaries might teach you a lot, but they're a little tedious. This is a really excellent film. So, once again, I encourage you, it's free. It's a good opportunity if you have an hour and a half on Wednesday night to see an interesting film. At the end of the film, there's going to be a Skype conversation with the head of the Textile Workers Union in Bangalore, India. So you'll be able to ask questions. And I mean that, seriously, this will be dialogue. If you see the film and you have a question you'd like to ask a labor organizer in the textile industry in Bangalore, India, after the film, you'll have an opportunity to do so. So I really encourage you to come. I think it'll be a good thing to do. A new section of the course, Inequality and Fairness. We're now leaving the area of the course in which we encountered some of the most difficult, in the sense technical, issues. Discussing finance in one lecture was really an impossible task to get at the details of exactly how a system as complicated as that works. Now we're hitting the heart of sociology. If there's a topic that is the kind of home turf of sociology, it's the problem of social inequality and how to think about it. This is also the area of where my own research has been most focused. My research as a sociologist has focused around the problems of class and class inequality and how to understand it, both as a theoretical problem, what do we even mean by the idea of class? We'll discuss that in the next lecture. And as an empirical question, how do we track its changes over time? This is a part of the course which I think will resonate deeply with many of you. In one of the weeks, we'll be discussing the problem of gender inequality, and that's a form of inequality which we all deeply live and experience in different ways. And also the section on race, which is a very hot and difficult and deep topic. And also, if I can say so, an intellectually interesting topic. And it's just, they're interesting intellectual puzzles around trying to really understand how these systems work. Well, we're going to begin today with a kind of introduction that's going to focus on what I would call the moral issues bound up with inequality. It's basically trying to answer the question, why should we care? There's two reasons why you would want to study inequality. There's two kinds of motivations that come. One is moral concern. How do we think about inequality? When are inequalities justified? When are they not? As a simple descriptive fact about the world, inequalities are linked to what could be called avoidable forms of human suffering. And if there's forms of human suffering that could be remedied but are not, you need a justification. I think that's a pretty simple point. You see suffering. There is a solution. It's not solved. The solution is bound up with the problem of inequality. You need a justification for not doing something about it. Well, that's a moral issue. What are the justifications for certain kinds of inequality? Secondly, inequalities figure in sociological explanations, quite apart from any moral concern, right? So the degree of inequality in a society helps to explain, for example, the levels of social conflict, helps to explain epidemics, helps to explain social disorder, crime. All sorts of things are tied to the degree of inequality in a society. So if you want to explain those sorts of things, even if you're not primarily doing it because of any moral issues around inequality as such, you need to understand how inequality works. Well, today we're going to begin this journey by looking at these moral issues. And this also bears on, going back to the very first lecture, one of the core values which animate this course, the value of fairness. So we'll begin by trying to think about what we really mean when we talk about fairness, when we use words like justice, injustice. What are we talking about? Well, here's the basic problem. We observe in the world all sorts of social inequality. Some people are better off than others. Some people are rich, some people are poor. Some people live flourishing lives, other people languish. These are just observations. We then ask the question, is the inequality we're observing just or fair? Does it violate some moral principle? Some inequalities are just bad luck. I mean, you know, two people walking down the road, a bolt of lightning comes, there's a thunderstorm brewing, and one person of the two gets hit by lightning. We would certainly say there is a dramatic inequality in the fate of these two people. And I think there's a sense in which, as kids often would say, that's not fair. He didn't deserve that. There's a kind of instinct almost. I think this is probably something pretty hardwired. I think it's true in every culture. There's a kind of instinct. When a misfortune happens, you ask yourself, well, did the person deserve it? As if a misfortune is a kind of punishment, right? And did you deserve it or not? And kids do this all the time. Somebody gets sick and they can't go to a party. When I was seven or eight, Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus came to the town in which I lived, and I couldn't go to the circus parade because I had the measles. And I have this memory of being really angry and saying, it's not fair. Of course it wasn't fair. You know, I didn't deserve to get the measles. But there's no injustice in that. It's just unfortunate. It's just too bad. This reflects, I think, a kind of bedrock intuition about how we would like the world to be. You know, if you could snap your fingers, you'd like it to be that people should get what they deserve and deserve what they get. It's a kind of simple-minded view, but it resonates. It resonates. Makes sense. Well, that's about unfairness. Unfairness is a question often just of bad luck. What we mean when we talk about social justice is something more complicated. What we mean is that there's an inequality which is unfair, but something could be done in principle to eliminate the unfairness. An unfairness that persists even though we could do something to eliminate it, that begins to be an injustice, not just an unfairness. Many easy examples that make this distinction. African Americans were denied admission to all white universities in many parts of the United States until the 1960s. That was certainly unfair, but it wasn't just bad luck to be born black. That would be a ridiculous way, I think, of describing the nature of the unfairness. This gross fair inequality could have been remedied by a change in social institutions, and eventually it was. The unfairness was an injustice because something could have been done about it. This doesn't necessarily mean it was politically possible to do something about it. The desegregation of schooling and universities in the South was not politically possible until after the Second World War. The balance of forces, the nature of Southern elites, the deal that was made nationally, the compromise around race between the North and the South, the way the Southern politicians worked in Congress. I mean, all these kinds of social forces work together to prevent the desegregation of education and universities in the South until after the Second World War, for various really interesting reasons. Why then? Why not earlier? So it was only politically feasible at a certain time, but that doesn't mean it was just beforehand. It was still an injustice. Slavery in the United States was a gross injustice, even in 1820, when it was utterly impossible to do anything about it. The political forces simply could not have eliminated slavery in the United States until later in the century. So the political feasibility isn't the issue. The question of whether an unfairness is an injustice has to do with whether, in principle, a change in social institutions could be organized so as to eliminate the unfairness. Most people, I mean, you know, there are historians and philosophers who will dispute this point, but most people now say slavery is an injustice. And they're prepared to say it was an injustice at the time of the founding of the American state. You know, it was an injustice in 1776. It was an injustice in 1783 when the Constitution was passed. It was an injustice then. But it was an injustice that you couldn't do anything about. You couldn't actually overcome. This makes the idea of justice, social justice, unjust inequalities really complicated, because it involves two kinds of judgments. First, there's a judgment that some inequality is unfair. And second, there's a judgment that in principle it could be remedied by a social change. That's a complicated combination of moves that you have to make in order to really establish an injustice. It's unfair. It's not fair that some children are born with severe physical disabilities and have to live their life in a wheelchair. That's just not fair. They don't deserve it. But it's not in and of itself an injustice that a child is disabled. The absence of a curb cut in the street, which makes it difficult for a person in a wheelchair to have mobility in a city, that's an injustice. The Americans for Disability Act, which was passed in the early 1970s, rectified an injustice. It rectified an injustice by giving people who were in wheelchairs the possibility of something closer to equality of mobility, right? So we observe an inequality beforehand. Some people find it easy to navigate a street on a sidewalk, going from street to street. Other people, it was impossible. That inequality was an injustice because it could be remedied. And that's what the Americans with Disability Act did. Of course, the Americans with Disability Act imposed all sorts of costs on the society. You have to retrofit buildings. You have to create ramps. You have to create doors that open, you know, with the little buttons in the front. I knew all this. I only began to really appreciate it in the last few months when I myself, for the first time, actually had an impairment that kept me from easily navigating the world. And when I, for a time, I was in a wheelchair before I was allowed to put any weight on my leg, and I really suddenly came to appreciate curb cuts and automatic door openers and ramps, things like that. Well, that's, you get the difference between just an unfairness and an injustice. Well, this is actually not so simple once you bore more deeply. Here are four cases. These all involve cases of possible injustice. All right, so these are cases in which we observe some inequalities, and we ask ourselves the question, should we care about this, or is this just the way things are? So let's look at these cases, four cases. First, a police chief will only hire personal relatives, sons, daughters, and cousins as police officers. It's a public police chief, not a private security guard, right? This is a police chief. Rampant nepotism. Well, most people in our culture would say, not just, well, that's unfair, but it's unjust. It's unfair and it could be remedied. The police chief could follow the law about hiring on a meritocratic basis, anybody who applies and satisfies the conditions of employment. The second case is quite different. A small shop owner is only willing to have his son or daughter become a co-owner of the store. Well, I think most people would say there's nothing wrong with that. You own a store and you want to have a co-owner and you want your children to inherit the store, so you bring them on board. That's just fine. Even though it, of course, means that there's an unequal opportunity for other people. They don't have an equal chance to become an owner of that store. No, but most people would say there's really no problem with that. Case number three, inheriting $10 million from a grandfather. Well, that's a little bit trickier. Inheriting $10 million from a grandfather, you're 30 years old, you suddenly have this huge windfall, you can start a business, your friends can't. Well, there's certainly an inequality there. It does seem kind of unfair that you have all these advantages and they don't. It's not because of your efforts or your responsibility or diligence, just because of the luck of having a rich grandfather. But still, I think, certainly in the United States, most people feel, no, that's probably okay. You might be a little squeamish around the edges. You might feel a little bit of moral hesitation around the inequality that's generated by large inheritances. But mostly people feel, no, that's not unjust. We don't need to rectify that inequality by preventing the transfer of wealth from one generation to another. But we might have to think about some other thing to do given that there is such transfers. We'll discuss that in a bit. Finally, case four. In one of the richest countries of the world, there are millions of people, children and adults, who live in desperate poverty. Poverty in the midst of plenty. That begins to seem pretty dicey with respect to the idea of unfairness and injustice. Maybe for the adults, you know, people screw up, they should take responsibility for their own lives. Maybe for adults, if they live in dire poverty and you diagnose the reasons why, you might say, well, too bad, tough luck. Life's not fair, but it's not unjust. It's pretty tough, I think, to say there's no problem, there's no moral issue involved when you have lots of children who live in really desperate poverty in a context that is in other respects very wealthy. Poverty of children in the midst of plenty is pretty hard to treat as just a matter of moral indifference. Well, why does this matter? Why does it matter whether you think of a form of inequality as being just or unjust? It matters, and this is a super important point, but not the kind of point that's easy to put on an exam. This is an important point just to think about. So sometimes I say, aha, pay attention, this is an important point because you're likely to be asked a question about it. I probably won't ask a question about this point, but I do think it's really important. The moral dimensions of inequality matter because it matters politically. It matters for how you justify doing things in public policy to deal with various kinds of social problems. And this matters because people are more likely to support a remedy when they think it remedies a real injustice. In politics, people support policies for two different kinds of reasons. This is an oversimplification, but I think it captures mostly the reason people support particular public policies. One, it's in my interest. I'll be better off if this policy is enacted. As a well-paid University of Wisconsin professor, I should be in favor of tax cuts all the time because I pay higher taxes than some people because I have a good salary, and I'll be better off if I have lower taxes. So if all I cared about was my own personal income, I would be gung-ho about lower taxes. But there's another reason why people support policies. They support policies because they think it's the right thing to do. They think it satisfies some moral condition. That's why I'm for tax raises. I think I'm undertaxed. I think the United States has far too low a rate of taxation to deal with the urgent problems which we face. We'll be discussing that issue, particularly in the third part of the course when we talk about democracy and taxation. So if you are a rich person, you could support tax cuts for the rich because it's in your personal interests. But there are many rich people, Warren Buffett, for example, one of the richest people in the United States, who argue strongly for increasing taxes on the rich because they think this is the moral thing to do, the fair thing to do. And it's notable that when you hear people arguing for tax cuts for the rich, it's never argued for on the grounds that this is good for the rich, right? The current political debates about whether we should have a big, massive tax reform which lowers taxes on the wealthy, the argument for it is not they should be even richer. No, the argument is that'll be good for everybody. Now, the fact that people feel the only way to defend tax cuts on wealthy people is to also argue that it's good for everybody else. The reason people make the argument that way is because these moral concerns enter into people's judgment about what policies to support and what policies to oppose. And that's why it really matters to get these things sorted out. That's why it matters to get things sorted out. Okay. Now let's turn to how we diagnose inequalities. That's just setting the stage as to why this is something worth doing. Now let's look at the substance of the question. Principles by which we judge inequality. There's a useful contrast between two ways of thinking about this. If you want a nice little sort of moniker for these, it's the idea of fair play in contrast to fair shares. This is two different ways in which you can say, aha, that level of inequality is unfair. It can violate the principle of fair play, or it could violate the principle of fair shares. Let me explain what each of these means. Fair play. This is a moral judgment about procedures, not outcomes. Fairness means, to use the sports metaphor, a level playing field. Level is better than equal playing field there. No discrimination, no special privileges. The results are that high levels of inequalities of the outcomes are fair so long as the outcomes were obtained through equal opportunity. No one cheated. Aaron Rodgers deserves his high salary because he's an extraordinary football player. He didn't cheat, unlike some other football players perhaps, but you know, he's a straight guy. He played by the rules, and he deserves what he gets. People should get what they deserve and deserve what they get. Well, if you don't cheat and you work hard, as long as it's a level playing field, it doesn't matter what the outcomes are. That's the fair play view. The fair play view. The fair share view says, no, we need to make a moral judgment about the outcome, not just the procedures. The outcomes matter. It matters how much inequality gets generated by the procedures, no matter how fair the procedures themselves might be. But we are justified in making judgments about the outcome. Fairness with respect to fair shares means that everyone is entitled to a share of society's resources sufficient to live a dignified, flourishing life. That means to have enough to be able to participate fully in the exercise of rights and liberties, to be able to exercise and develop one's talent, to live in a respectable, culturally acceptable, unstigmatized way. Everybody has a right to at least that share, rather than simply a right to equal opportunity on a level playing field. The focus here is on the fairness of outcome. Everyone has a human right to good health care, decent housing, decent nutrition. And the levels of inequality are unfair if it is true, if it is the case, that some people are denied access to reasonable health care, reasonable housing, reasonable nutrition. And you can develop that list however you want. That's the fair share view. Now, most research that has studied attitudes of Americans in this particular corner of the world, most research on this indicates that fair play is the dominant American view of fairness. That's why the expression equal opportunity looms so large in the rhetoric of politics. We have a fairness agency in the United States government called the Equal Opportunity Commission. It's not the Equal Quality of Life Commission. It's the Equal Opportunity Commission. Equal opportunity. It's a powerful idea. Both principles, however, I think are still present. Most people still find levels of inequality in which some people are absolutely destitute. It makes them uncomfortable. But fair play is really the dominant idea. I think, in fact, there is a less prominent but still real fair shares intuition that undergirds most people's beliefs about equal opportunity. And I'd like to share a video with you, which I think I'll be able to get to work. And I will.
There's a chart I saw recently that I can't get out of my head. A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States. This is what they said they thought it was. Dividing the country into five rough groups of the top, bottom, and middle three 20% groups, they asked people,
whoops, just a minute.
How about the wealth in this country?
I see we're having a problem here. Just a second. For whatever reasons with this, let's see. I do not know why I continue to have trouble getting this to. Let's see, now I think we're going to get there. Yeah, okay, we'll start over. Sorry about that.
There's a chart I saw recently that I can't get out of my head. A Harvard business professor and economist asked more than 5,000 Americans how they thought wealth was distributed in the United States. This is what they said they thought it was. Dividing the country into five rough groups of the top, bottom, and middle three 20% groups, they asked people how they thought the wealth in this country was divided. Then they asked them what they thought was the ideal distribution. And 92%, that's at least 9 out of 10 of them, said it should be more like this. In other words, more equitable than they think it is. Now that fact is telling, admittedly, the notion that most Americans know that the system is already skewed unfairly. But what's most interesting to me is the reality compared to our perception. The ideal is as far removed from our perception of reality as the actual distribution is from what we think exists in this country. So ignore the ideal for a moment. Here's what we think it is again. And here is the actual distribution. Shockingly skewed. Not only do the bottom 20% and the next 20%, the bottom 40% of Americans barely have any wealth. I mean, it's hard to even see them on the chart. But the top 1% has more of the country's wealth than 9 out of 10 Americans believe the entire top 20% should have. Mind blowing. But let's look at it another way, because I find this chart kind of difficult to wrap my head around. Instead, let's reduce the 311 million Americans to just a representative 100 people. Make it simple. Here they are: teachers, coaches, firefighters, construction workers, engineers, doctors, lawyers, some investment bankers, CEO, maybe a celebrity or two. Now let's line them up according to their wealth. Poorest people on the left, wealthiest on the right, just a steady row of folks based on net worth. We'll color code them like we did before based on which 20% quintile they fall into. Now let's reduce the total wealth of the United States, which was roughly $54 trillion in 2009, to this symbolic pile of cash, and let's distribute it among our 100 Americans. Well, here's socialism, all the wealth of the country distributed equally. We all know that won't work. We need to encourage people to work and work hard to achieve that good old American dream and keep our country moving forward. So, here's that ideal we asked to learn about, something like this curve. This isn't too bad. We've got some incentive, as the wealthiest folks are now about 10 to 20 times better off than the poorest Americans. But hey, even the poor folks aren't actually poor, since the poverty line has stayed almost entirely off the chart. We have a super healthy middle class, with a smooth transition into wealth. And yes, Republicans and Democrats alike chose this curve. 9 out of 10 people, 92%, said this was a nice, ideal distribution of America's wealth. But let's move on. This is what people think America's wealth distribution actually looks like. Not as equitable, clearly, but for me, even this still looks pretty great. Yes, the poorest 20-30% are starting to suffer quite a lot compared to the ideal, and the middle class is certainly struggling more than they were, while the rich and wealthy are making roughly 100 times that of the poorest Americans, and about 10 times that of the still healthy middle class. Sadly, this isn't even close to the reality. Here's the actual distribution of wealth in America. The poorest Americans don't even register. They're not in pocket change. And the middle class is barely distinguishable from the poor. In fact, even the rich between the top 10 and 20 percentile are worse off. Only the top 10% are better off. And how much better off? So much better off that the top 2-5% are actually off the chart at this scale. And the top 1%, this guy, well, his stack of money stretches 10 times higher than we can show. Here's his stack of cash, restacked, all by itself. This is the top 1% we've been hearing so much about. So much grain in his pockets that I have to give him a whole new column of his own, because he won't fit on my chart. 1% of America has 40% of all the nation's wealth. The bottom 80%, 8 out of every 10 people, or 80 out of these 100, only has 7% between them. And this has only gotten worse in the last 20 to 30 years. While the richest 1% take home almost a quarter of the national income today, in 1976, they took home only 9%, meaning their share of income has nearly tripled in the last 30 years. The top 1% own half the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of these investments, which means they aren't investing. They're just scraping by. I'm sure many of these wealthy people have worked very hard for their money, but do you really believe that the CEO is working 380 times harder than his average employee? And not his lowest paid employee, not the janitor, but the average earner in his company. The average worker needs to work more than a month to earn what the CEO makes in 1 hour. We certainly don't have to go all the way to socialism to find something that is fair for hardworking Americans. We don't even have to achieve what most of us consider might be ideal. All we need to do is wake up and realize that the reality in this country is not at all what we think it is.
So my point in showing this film, which I think is pretty powerful. Let's see if we are back at the...
There are 186 countries in the world. 25 of them are very rich.
Just a bit.
Close
tabs. Now I turned everything off. You'd think after teaching here for 40 years, I would have these very simple, obvious things mastered. But, alas. Okay, let's go to where we were. Okay. The reason I showed the film was both because it's pretty powerful, I think, and really bringing home the magnitude of the inequality, but also in that comparison with what average people think is both the ideal and the reality, that shows really that I think people do have a fair play intuition, a fair share intuition, as well as a fair play. They have an idea of what would be a good distribution. Yes, you had your hand up. Oh, that's just the audio system. Okay, no buzz, we're okay? Good. Well, these are just the same representations of the data. It'll be on the PowerPoint so you can see it. You can also watch the film again if you want, or show friends by going to the PowerPoint and clicking on it. You'll get the link to the video. What's kind of interesting is this chart, which compares the distributions being compared here are those, these are preferred distributions. You show people these distributions and ask them, which do you think would be best? Distribution B for wealth is about what exists in Sweden. Distribution A is the actual distribution in the United States, and distribution C doesn't exist anywhere. That's perfect equality of wealth. And if you ask Americans which of these would you prefer, the ironic thing is that that more Americans prefer Sweden to the United States in terms of the actual distributions of wealth. This is of wealth, not of income, of wealth. How much you own, not how much you earn, in these countries. So fair play and fair share are both important. Most people, I think, their gut reaction is, yeah, if we had an equal playing field, then inequalities don't matter very much, what comes out. But they still have an intuition that, yes, there'd be some degrees of inequality that would be a problem, even apart from the fair play issue. The biggest difficulty for the fair play principle is children. That's really where it just becomes difficult to fully embrace fair play. So long as children are raised by parents, then massive inequality in the life circumstances of parents just necessarily undermines equal opportunity for children. You see, if you really take the problem of equal opportunity seriously, if you're honest about it and take it really seriously, then the distance between fair shares and fair play actually begins to diminish, because you have to have a certain degree of fair shares in order to have fair play. You can't have fair play for kids if the parents are impoverished. If we want to have children with remotely equal opportunities in life, then we cannot allow children to grow up in desperate poverty, or even in moderate poverty. This means that if you're serious about equal opportunity, about fair play, if that is your moral standard, then you have to consider the problem of the distribution of outcomes, fair shares, as a means of achieving even rough equality of opportunity. So this is a pretty disturbing point. I mean, it really is unsettling to a lot of standard views of things. If you take the idea of real meaningful equality of opportunity, if that's the goal, then you probably have to also accept a certain amount of redistribution. You can't be indifferent to the inequalities of outcomes if you're serious about equality of opportunity. Now, there is another response to this, which is, life isn't fair, it's a dog-eat-dog world, survival of the fittest, too bad if there are children in poverty. That's just the way the world is. Because it's human nature to try to be on top, and might makes right. Well, it's pretty tough in a rich country where survival of the fittest has such brutal consequences in the lives of others to really take that on as your moral stance towards the world. I think it's hard. And I don't think that corresponds to most people's gut feelings. The reason why, in the face of these realities, people might still oppose redistribution, the intuitions they have is that it is only going to make things worse, that it actually can't solve the problem. That is, remember, an unfairness becomes an injustice when you can remedy it. Well, the real argument that does have some bite is the cure will be worse than the disease. You just can't do anything about it. Well, if that's true, then it is a sad fact of life. Poverty in the midst of plenty. Children living in desperate poverty. That would be just a sad fact of life if it were true that every government effort to do something about it simply makes life worse because of government incompetence or government malevolence. Remember that pair of ideas from early on in the semester. All right, well, let's now look at some complications. First, I want to explore what might be called defenses of unjust inequalities. Now, that might seem a bizarre thing to say. How can you acknowledge that an inequality is unjust and still defend it? It would seem that that calling an inequality unjust in and of itself means that you can't defend it. Well, the reason an unjust inequality could be defended is because of conflicting values. The means needed to rectify the injustice may violate some other important value. So it's not that you couldn't remedy the injustice, it's just that if you did remedy the injustice, you would violate some other principle that you care about even more than you care about justice. So, for example, here's a really simple example. To ensure that all children had equality of educational opportunity, to really ensure this would require putting restrictions on what parents are allowed to do for their children. Rich parents would not be allowed to send their kids to super expensive private schools. Why do rich parents send their kids to super expensive, high-quality private schools? It's to give their kids an advantage. That's the motivation for it. They think their kids will do better in life, in the competition, in the market, and in life in general, if they spend their resources to put their kids in a high-quality, super expensive private school. It is designed by design. It's not just an accident. It's designed to give them an advantage, and because they can do it and not everybody can do it, it's an unfair advantage. So if you really wanted to create equal quality of opportunity, you'd have to abolish high expensive private schools. But we also play a value on parents being able to help their children. That's a real value. It's a value I hold. Both because we value the parent-child relationship, because we believe that parents, because of love and commitment and those deep and important bonds, should be able to do whatever they can for the well-being of their children, but also because we value freedom of choice. And giving special help to your child is a choice. It's an exercise of your autonomy and freedom. So to truly rectify an unjust inequality of opportunity for poor children, this would conflict with the values of parental rights on the one hand, the right to do whatever you can to help your child, and the rights of private property, the right to spend your money how you wish. So these are conflicting values. It's an injustice that poor kids can't get access to rich schools, but it would be a violation of the values that we care about for parenting and for property rights if we blocked wealthy parents from giving those advantages to children. Now, if you believe in this conflict of values, that however unfortunate it is, the value of parental rights and property rights are more important than social justice, than the violation of the principle of equality of opportunity, then the honest moral stance to take is not to pretend that this is a just outcome, but simply that these other values are more important to you than justice. But if you do this, if you acknowledge that as if the principle was we should all be honest about our values and these trade-offs, if wealthy people said, yes, I know this is a deep injustice to poor families, but the value of my autonomy to do what I want for my kids is more important, then you should not object to taxation on high incomes designed to improve the schools for the poor. The really morally dishonest position, in my judgment, is to simultaneously say, yes, I have the right to send my children to private schools and give them a tremendous advantage in life because I'm rich, to say that's more important than justice, and to say we should not increase taxation to produce the best possible quality schools for everyone. You cannot consistently, in my judgment, be against high taxation and for private schools. If you're taking a moral, if that is, as long as you believe that poverty of children is an injustice. But there are conflicts of values, and those conflicts are real, and that's why you could sometimes say we have to put up with an injustice. There's another kind of argument that defends unjust inequality, and those are what I would call pragmatic arguments. Remember, we encountered pragmatic arguments about the market before, not just the moral defense of the market, but the pragmatic. To remind you, a pragmatic argument is an argument that focuses on practical consequences rather than social justice as such. So, what are the pragmatic arguments in favor of high levels of unjust economic inequality? So these are just practical arguments. It's not saying it's a good thing in and of itself. We could remedy the inequality, but there are practical reasons for not doing so. So here's the thesis. Inequality leads to incentives. It gives people incentives to work hard, to try to gain, because there are unequal rewards available. Incentives lead people to work harder than they would work in the absence of those incentives. Because people work harder, this generates prosperity, and prosperity ultimately benefits the poor. So we need inequality to generate the incentives to get people to work hard in ways that generate prosperity, which ultimately benefits the poor. Thesis two takes it one step further. It's not just that we need some inequality to produce the needed incentives, but rather, greater inequality produces greater incentives, which will lead to greater prosperity, which will produce even more benefits for the poor. That's the argument behind tax cuts for the very wealthy in a context where we have the level of inequality we already have. We have huge inequalities now. The argument is we need even more inequality. That would be even better for the poor. And that's this thesis too. Inequalities generated by free voluntary market processes uninterfered with by things like taxation and government programs are precisely the optimal level of inequality on pragmatic grounds. That's a pretty wild idea. You know, on the face of it, it's not very plausible that the levels of inequality that spontaneously get produced in the market are precisely the levels needed for maximum benefit for those who are least advantaged. But that's the implicit argument that says it's always better to have more tax cuts on the rich in order to increase their incentives. And the corollary, the kind of thesis number three, that is the flip side, reducing inequality reduces incentives and thus harms the poor. The practical policy implication of this is tax cuts for the very rich, trickle-down economics. That is basically the core of the pragmatic argument for the desirability of inequality, even if you could reduce it. You wouldn't want to reduce it because it actually doesn't, it makes people worse off if you reduce it. Well, let me give you, let's turn now to criticisms of this pragmatic argument. The first one is a kind of technical one. This harkens back a little bit to the economics-y language we've been using in the first part of the course. It's a first criticism of the pragmatic argument is what is called endogenous preferences. That is, the preference people have for incentives, how much incentive do you need in order to work harder, depends upon how much inequality is in the society, rather than the inequality simply reflects people's preferences. The level of inequality creates the preferences for inequality. Let me just illustrate this simply. Here's two possible worlds: a low inequality world where CEOs earn 10 times average workers, and then these are levels in the hierarchy of management of a large corporation, and a high inequality world where CEOs earn 300 times. So these are two possible worlds, and these are in fact possible worlds because there have been wealthy countries in which the ratio of CEOs to workers were, you know, roughly in the 10 to 20 to 1 ratio in large corporations, and the world in which we live now in the United States is where the ratio between top and the average worker is in the order of magnitude of 300 to 1 in large corporations. So the idea here is that if you're living in world number one, the raise from $35,000 to $50,000 as you're promoted from level 5 to 4 is a big deal. That really is a good incentive for you. And the raise from 170 to 250 as you go from the layer below the CEO to the CEO is also seen as a really significant raise. You got $80,000 more a year. In the amount of incentive needed to motivate you to work hard in order to get promoted then is something you learn from the nature of the inequalities you face, rather than you just simply have a preference that's exogenous, that's outside of the system, which says, well, if I'm at level one, I'm not going to work very hard to get to the top unless I can jump from 2 million to 7.5 million. So you see the point? That's why the idea is preferences are endogenous to the structure of inequality. If you live in a world of high inequality, then you feel, in order to be motivated to work hard, I need to get that really big, fat reward. If you live in a world of small inequalities, then you'll work hard to get the smaller reward. One of the things this reflects is that actually, in terms of what's motivating people, it's as much the recognition and status that you get from moving up and getting more rewards, as it is the absolute amount that you get. So that's the first criticism, endogenous preferences. That's a criticism of the argument, particularly for thesis number two. Remember, thesis number two back here was greater inequality leads to greater incentives. It's rather that greater inequality requires greater incentives because it generates these endogenous preferences. Second criticism of the pragmatic argument, the role of power in generating inequality. What's the difference between an incentive and what we might call extortion? So here's just a crude example. A robber holds a gun to your head and says, your money or your life. Is paying the robber an incentive for not shooting you? No, I mean, you wouldn't want to use the word incentives to describe what you've done. You have been coerced through an exercise of power into giving up your resources to the robber. Well, that is partially what's going on in the generation of large inequalities in a society. Elites always claim that privilege is necessary as an incentive, but this can just be an exercise of their power. Privileged elites will always say they need more to work hard, to produce, to save, but this is really just a bluff in many cases. Think of this as a game in which there are threats and bluffs backed by power. Ultimately, the outcome, how much inequality you'll have in a society, depends upon the balance of power, where how that political game of struggle over the level of inequality is played out. In the context of the United States over the last 40 years, the way in which this has been played out is through the deregulation of corporations, the shift in the way boards of directors are instructed to deal with the salary structures of their firms, and all sorts of other power relations, which explains why inequality increased so dramatically over the last 3 or 4 decades. Finally, as a criticism of pragmatic, the pragmatic argument for inequality, is that the levels of inequality that we actually have are excessive with respect to even the pragmatic argument. We have more inequality than is needed for incentives for people to work hard. Managers and executives worked very hard in the 1950s, the years when the American economy grew at its most rapid rate. It was an innovative, high productivity, developing capitalist economy with lots of incentives, but the levels of inequality were much less. Those are pragmatic arguments criticizing the pragmatic argument in favor of inequality. Now I want to give pragmatic arguments against high inequality. So what the previous set of discussion, the previous points were all about was why the defense of inequality doesn't work. Now I want to show why why inequality, high levels of inequality on pragmatic grounds is a bad thing. This is quite apart from whether we also have a moral issue. Just why pragmatically it's problematic. First, high inequality leads to resentment and conflict. Resentment and conflict erodes a sense of community and cooperation. And this lowers productivity, which reduces prosperity. High inequality leads to conflict. For example, the levels of social disorder in our deteriorating central cities is bound up with problems of inequality and the poverty that comes in the wake of inequality. Prisons are costly. California spends more on prisons than it does on universities. I suspect Wisconsin does as well, but I don't have the specific data for Wisconsin. That's a cost. And that reduces productivity and reduces prosperity. So the first reason why high levels of inequality is pragmatically wrong is that it creates inefficiencies. It's costly. It lowers productivity. Secondly, high inequality leads to concentrations of wealth, which lead to concentrations of power, which erode democracy. High levels of inequality are not just bad in and of themselves if you have moral concerns, and it's not just bad because it actually reduces productivity, it's costly. High levels of inequality are bad because it is also corrosive of democracy. That's an issue we'll discuss in more detail in the third part of the course, when we look at the relationship between wealth and democratic institutions. And finally, and this may be the most surprising, high inequality actually harms almost everyone, even the relatively affluent. Now that's a strange idea. You'd think that whatever else might be true about inequality, if you're at least near the top, it's good for you. Well, it turns out to not be so simple. High inequality creates problems in the society as a whole, which actually has deleterious consequences, at least for most people, not necessarily for elites, but for most people. And to show this, I'm going to go through a series of slides that present really interesting empirical evidence from a very influential book by Wilkinson and Pickett called The Spirit Level. A comment about this title, which is a ridiculous title in my judgment. The expression spirit level is British, and it's for the carpenter's level, you know, with the little glass thing, and it's about how inequality makes the level, the bubble, go one direction or another. The metaphor I find completely unhelpful. I asked Wilkinson about it, and he likes the title. I mean, obviously, he picked the title. What the book is about is the consequences for the society as a whole of living under a high inequality or low inequality social structure. And I'm going to show you a bunch of very striking graphs. So here's the first one. Wilkinson and Pickett created an index that is a kind of aggregate of what could be called health and social problems. It combines in a complex statistical way, you know, we don't need to go into how they created the index. It's pretty sophisticated by the standards of contemporary statistical analysis. So this is an index that combines life expectancy, math and literacy, infant mortality, homicides, imprisonment, teenage births, trust, obesity, mental illness, and social mobility. So it takes all of these things, mushes them together, does a factor analysis of some sort to create this index. And that means what the index does is it enables you to say, all things considered, on all of these dimensions, mushed together in a fancy way, we can go from better to worse. It's not that they all hang together perfectly, but they hang together pretty well. And you get then a single one-dimensional number, which is a useful thing. And then we look at countries. So here are wealthy countries, mostly. I think they're all OECD countries, which vary in their degrees of inequality and from low to high, and vary from better to worse on this complicated index. And there's two things to note. First, this rather steep upward slope. And second, that even given the upward slope, the United States is an outlier. It's even above the slope. You know, it's has way worse outcomes and has the highest levels of inequality. This next graph shows that this relationship between the index and inequality is not because there's some other relationship between the level of national income, how rich the society is, and these problems. So these are the same countries now rated not from low to high inequality, but from poor to rich, or less. These are all relatively affluent countries. Even Portugal, which is at the bottom, is still, by world standards, a developed country. And you can see there's no relationship. It's a completely non-connection. Doesn't matter how wealthy you are. What matters is how unequal you are, not how rich you are. This also holds for states in the United States, going from unequal to equal. Wisconsin, this is 2009 data, so it's a little bit old, but you know, the basic structure of these relationships won't change. A particular state might move somewhat. Wisconsin is a relatively egalitarian state. We have less inequality. We have less billionaires in Wisconsin than in most, than many other states. And fewer, as a percentage of our population, even fewer desperately poor people, although the racial distribution of poverty in Wisconsin is among the worst in the country. We nevertheless have relatively fewer desperately poor people in Wisconsin. So we have a relatively low inequality by American standards. As you see, this basic relationship holds in the US. Now, breaking down these data from this aggregate index to more refined, This is a United Nations children's, forget what the E stands for, fund. F is fund. UNICEF Index of Child Well-Being. Again, going from high to low. And again, the higher the inequality, the worse off children are. And again, child well-being is not a function of how wealthy the country is among wealthy countries, right? So this isn't saying for the whole world. Of course, it's better to live in a rich country than a really poor country. But among the countries that have reached a reasonable level of development, it's no longer the case that if the country becomes even richer, children become better off. What is true is that if the country becomes more unequal, children are worse off. This is a different sort of index. This is an index that measures people's attitudes about trusting. You have a simple-minded survey question of the form, can you trust most people? I mean, I don't know if that's the exact wording, but it's something like that. And do you strongly agree? Do you agree? Do you disagree? That just take a person that you meet, are they likely to be trustworthy? The more inequality, the less social trust there is. The same is true for inequality within states. It's really interesting. I mean, this as a sociological fact of the world, that you get the same correlation, the same basic pattern when you're comparing whole countries, the levels of inequality in whole countries, than when you're comparing the levels of inequality within US states. That's a pretty interesting fact about the way these mechanisms are working. Requires a lot of thinking about why that would be true. Why is the same process true, whatever the scale, whether you're looking at subunits within a country or national units? Here's another index. I'm just piling this on one thing after another. This is another index, which is the prevalence of mental illness. The more unequal, the higher the levels of mental illness. Percent with any mental illness, again, determined by various standard indicators. Life expectancy. Life expectancy is longer in more equal rich countries than in less equal. This isn't just life expectancy for people at the bottom. It's the median, the life expectancy for the person in the middle of the distribution, right? That's life expectancy measured at the median, not at just at the bottom. Infant mortality, again. The higher the inequality, the higher the levels of infant mortality. And again, the United States is not just high on both dimensions. It's not just in the right-hand corner. It's above the regression line, which means that there's something in addition to this relationship which pushes the United States mortality, infant mortality rates higher. Teenage birth rates, teenage pregnancies, are also way higher in the United States than anywhere else, quite apart from the inequality issue, but it is higher overall across countries the more unequal. And again, if you look at states, there's good old Wisconsin down at the bottom end of the distribution. The levels of inequality in Wisconsin, which make this a less polarized state economically, even if we are extremely polarized politically at the moment. And finally, and this is one of the most telling, social mobility. Because after all, if there's one myth about the United States which people really cherish, which is captured by the idea of the American dream, it's that, well, maybe we have more inequality, and maybe we have more poverty, and maybe we have all of these problems, but this is the land of opportunity. We have more mobility. Just not true. Mobility understood as the relationship between a parent's occupational or income or wealth status. So there's different ways of measuring it, but it's basically the difference between where you end up in a structure of inequality and where you began from your parents. The United States has lower levels of mobility, not higher levels. And furthermore, the more income inequality you have in a country, the lower the levels of mobility. Now, that shouldn't be so surprising, because after all, what does income inequality do? It means parents can give advantages to their kids. The high inequalities in the United States are translated into high inequalities of opportunity for children, which should lead you to predict that the more inequality, the less mobility. These are pretty robust findings, and they should be troubling to anyone who feels that the levels of inequality as such in the United States are not something about which we should be concerned. Well, in the lecture on Wednesday, I am going to take you into the very heart of my own research and theoretical work in the study of social class and how to think about it. See you then.